children.
It's all for you!
We have such sights to show you.
Yeah, you get cold.
Ugh. And my bones are all shitty anyways, so.
And you know what else is cold and shitty?
The setting of this movie?
Canada, where this movie was filmed.
Oh, man. And also kicked off by a car incident, so.
Yeah, let's Jesus.
Relevance.
Do you want to just go ahead and get started?
Yeah, let's go. All right.
Let's go ahead and get started. Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of the Horrible People's Podcast. Anthony is hanging on by a thread. I am joined by always, as always, with Anthony Fuentes.
Yeah, she got the sentence out. I am here.
I'm doing my best.
I don't know if you guys, people, fans who have followed me will realize that the catalyst of this movie in my situation about a week ago was very similar. I got hit by a car.
Like, he wasn't in a car.
I was walking across the street, and Miss Webster went home early, so she wasn't there to pick up my body as it flung in
the
air.
No, you know what it would have been? It really would have just been, like, that SpongeBob character when he's holding SpongeBob. He's just
Yeah. Or, like, the end of Donnie Darko.
Yeah, pretty much.
But with me instead in your arms.
No!
So, thank you to my friends who were there to recover my body on the ground.
Yeah, sorry I had to go home early.
No, it's okay. Obviously, it was a safer choice.
No, yeah, again, I keep telling him, I'm really glad I wasn't there because I would have been in jail. So.
Oh, yeah, you would have been on a fucking a movement against you. White girl yells at blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, right.
And I didn't get any psychic power, so.
But you weren't in a coma for 5 years.
Right. Shit.
Yeah.
Oh, would not want to do that.
No, that would have been worse.
I'm like, oh, wow, that's it. So the theaters are pretty much done, huh? Yeah, scary. Scary
thought. Anyway, we are talking about The Dead Zone from 1983.
Right, that's right. And yes. You know what that means.
It is Cronenberg Christmas.
Yes, it is.
Yay! First week of December. This is our fourth Cronenberg Christmas.
That's right. Four Cronenberg Christmases.
Down.
Yeah, exactly. We're burning through the filmography.
No, we're not. We have so much more to do.
No, we have a lot. That's true.
But I hope you guys enjoy this. I know this is like the most unconventional Cronenberg choice, but that's okay.
Yeah.
We have a lot to talk about. So let's dive right in with good old IMDb. Giving us the succinct as always.
No, succinct is 50% of the time. Sometimes it's too much, sometimes it's just this.
Yeah, sometimes it's this, which is, and I quote, "A man awakens from a coma to discover he has a psychic ability," unquote. That is it. That is the IMDb synopsis.
147 minutes. There you go, guys.
Yeah. Jesus. And man, does it feel like a 4-hour movie.
It's a long one.
Well, it's a short movie. It's like an hour and a half.
Yeah, but there's a very soggy middle, I would say.
We'll get into it. It is directed, of course, by David Cronenberg. The screenplay is by Jeffrey Boehm, based on The Dead Zone by Stephen King. Mm. So it's not only a Cronenberg Christmas, it's another Stephen King adaptation.
So many crossovers. Our 150th episode was also
crossovers?
Yeah, it was.
And it was produced by Deborah Hill. So,
of good old Halloween fame.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. So there's a lot of moving parts.
We got a pedigree here. Okay.
And yet we got this. Anyway, starring Christopher Walken, Brooke Adams, Tom Skerritt, Herbert Lom, Anthony Zerb, Colleen Dewhurst, and Martin Sheen.
Whoa, Martin Sheen being his most Martin Sheeny for sure.
Oh yeah. He is a person in this movie.
Gnawing on scenery. Oh man.
And this was released on October 21st, 1983. The budget was slightly debated for this, so it's either $7.1 million or $10 million, depending on who you ask.
Mm-hmm. It's always the more expensive one.
$10 million.
Yeah, yeah. $7.1 million is the PR
The
budget.
PR, it's like, this was a $7.1
million. Yeah, could you believe how successful it is?
And it made $20.8 million in the box office.
See, that's one difference of headline. It made back twice its budget, or it made back three times its budget. It's right there.
Right there.
Yeah, so they got to pick it. So, of course, being this surprising amalgamation of some big hitters in horror, and Christopher Walken. So we're going to get into how that happened. Mm. So.
And there's another surprise in here just for you.
Oh, fun. All right, let's read it then. The Dead Zone is loosely based upon the life of famous psychic Peter Hurkos. Hurkos claimed to have acquired his alleged, I almost read that as illegal, powers.
His illegal powers.
So his alleged powers after falling off a ladder and hitting his head. Which is a lot less dire than the catalyst for this film.
Yeah, I mean, they had to make it more dramatic. It's a movie. Yeah. It's Hollywood, baby.
No, Christopher Walken falling on a ladder, I think, would be very entertaining either way.
Whoa!
Oh, my God.
Whoa!
So, you can't see our arms. That was funny. Written in 1979, the novel by Stephen King was the first book of his to reach number one on the bestseller list, hardcover. A milestone for King, who said it was, quote, one of my most successful ever. And it was 428 pages long. So it's a beefy boy.
Yeah.
So after King's novel, The Dead Zone, was released, Lorimar Film Entertainment began developing, of course, a film adaptation as people did in the time. Because he, you know, Carrie. producer Carol Baum gave the book to screenwriter Jeffrey Baum.
Boehm. They're different people. Carol Baum and Jeffrey Boehm.
This is dumb already.
You just switch in the middle and then switch out a vowel. Oh, and boy. Like, there's an alphabet soup here.
Carol B and Jeffrey B. All right. And asked him to, of course, write a screenplay. Quote, I saw it had possibilities and agreed to do it. Boehm said. That is the Jeffrey of the equation. So, he developed a script with director Stanley Donen. These people are the dumbest names. Who left the project before the film had reached production at Lorimar. Boy, all right. There's a lot of people going. There's a lot of moving parts even in this.
So far, this is the beginning. This is pre-production.
Jesus. Lorimar eventually closed its film division after a series of box office failures, our favorite coverage here on the podcast. And soon after, of course, producer and Stromboli lover Dino De Laurentiis, that was a good one, bought the rights to the David Zone. A David Zone.
That's even worse than the Dead Zone.
Oh no! It's just David Levis Independence Day is fucking
David.
The Dead Zone, of course. Our spaghetti boy bought that shit. In addition to Donen, both John Badham.
Badham. It's Badham.
I like saying Badham better. Mr. Badham.
What? Mr. Badham. De Laurentiis, we'll see you now.
Yeah. I want to make you Mr. Goodham.
I may be a bad ham, right? But I could be a good man.
It's like a southern lawyer. I'm going to get this movie made. And Michael Cimino were also considered to direct. Just so you know, listeners, I am more high than I thought I should be.
Oh, no.
I didn't intend to do that. I thought my vape pen was broken.
Yeah,
so
also,
I did a test puff.
I know we keep making fun, but John Badham directed Saturday Night Fever, War Games, and Short Circuit.
Oh, wow.
And then Michael Cimino, I mean, we didn't make fun of him, but he directed The Deer Hunter.
Wow, that is very profound.
I know, we're just like, who are those people? They're directors.
Oh, they're a big deal. And honestly, it's pretty impressive to go from Saturday Night Fever, which is a very big cultural touchstone and like Academy level film, mm-hmm. to Short Circuit, which was 80s meme territory.
I love Short Circuit.
Oh, I love it too. But there's a big gap in terms of the style of movies.
I mean, yeah. Also, War Games. War Games is a good in-between.
That's true. He really had a transition. He's like, you know what? How about less serious? Serious makes me sad.
Yeah. He also did 1979's Dracula.
Oh, shit. Okay. Well, so, quite the pedigree right
it's
there.
It's true. But then, you know, I know we were making fun of him, but yeah. He's a person. Mm-hmm.
It's okay. Again, I'm more high than anticipated because it turns out
This is gonna be goofy.
Yeah,
I'm drinking a Mai Tai.
I know. No, my pen wasn't broken really.
It was just congested.
Clogged. It was clogged. Yes, yes. So, wow, that was that was horrible.
Let's bring it back.
Let's go.
We are
let's
the
go
horrible
back.
People. Let's bring it back.
All right. So, where was that?
Jesus.
Pasta Man initially disliked Boehm's screenplay and asked King to adapt his own novel. De Laurentiis then reportedly rejected King's script as, quote, involved and convoluted.
Yeah.
Jeez.
I mean, jeez.
You reject the king. It's his own fucking thing. And he had the power to do it. Because remember, Dino De Laurentiis, he was the man at this point in time. Sure, he really was.
And, you know, for those of you who haven't listened before, we mercilessly make fun of Dino De Laurentiis for no reason. He doesn't deserve it. He hasn't done anything wrong. It's just a very Italian name, so we're just assholes. Mm-hmm. Anyway, moving on.
Him and Dale Midkiff, they don't get any recourse, really.
None.
none of those people directed the film, though. Eventually, this found its way to David freaking Cronenberg, of course, who is what we kick off our Decembers with. And, of course, who said that he was the one who decided not to use the script, finding it, quote-unquote, needlessly brutal. Which, that's coming from Cronenberg, Jesus. De Laurentiis rejected a second script by, Andrzej Zulowski.
There's a way to pronounce his name, and
Andrzej Zulowski.
That's not it. And I meant to look it up so I could be like, actually, it's ha 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 ha. I'd laugh at your face, but I didn't do it.
I forgot.
Because I wrote this last week.
I know, I watched this last week, so I'm like, I hope I
can pull through. We're doing a plot walkthrough.
All right.
So it'll refresh the memory.
It'll come back.
Anyway, this guy is actually a pretty big deal, but I'm so sorry. I'm not even going to try to butcher attempt your name, because I will butcher it.
That's right. Mr.
Respect. AZ. Yeah.
But the script didn't make its way back to Baum, so he's just been in and out of this bitch.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. The film was finally on track to be made when De Laurentiis hired, of course, the G, producer Deborah Hill, to work with Cronenberg and Baum. So you got a pretty good pedigree here. It's a good-looking film. So it looks great. Baum abandoned King's parallel story structure for the Dead Zone screenplay, turning the plot into separate episodes. So, of course, Baum told screenwriter Tim Lucas in 1983, the year of Thriller, quote, King's book is longer than it needed to be. The novel sprawls and it's episodic. What I did was use the episodic quality because I saw the Dead Zone as a triptych.
Triptych. Do you know what that is?
No idea.
Okay, so it is, it's like a three-part, basically just think of it as something in three parts.
Okay, so like the format of this movie.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, yeah, okay, that makes sense. Because that's another thing, is the beginning, middle, and end, they're very distinct acts.
Mm-hmm.
Very distinct.
Yes.
So his script was revised and condensed 4 times by Cronenberg, who eliminated large portions of the novel story, including plot points about Johnny Smith having a brain tumor. So, I mean, that's Cronenberg's pretty good about this shit,
like,
though.
You almost went into it. It's not the tumor.
Yeah. I think it's just have Saturday Night Fever on my head. So that was a borderline Travolta. A near Travolta, something that happens frequently on this podcast.
A near Travolta. Mm-hmm.
One day Phil's going to slip and we're going to have to bring that up. Cronenberg, Baum, and Hill had script meetings to revise the screenplay page by page. Jesus, they're like, we don't trust you, buddy.
We're just going to go through this with a fine-tooth comb. Mm-hmm. The red pens are flying.
So Baum's triptych.
Triptych
in, I'm going to keep fucking that up. In the screenplay surrounds 3 acts. The introduction of Johnny Smith before his car accident and after he awakens from his coma. A story about Smith assisting a sheriff in tracking down the Castle Rock Killer, a.k.a. the most boring part of the film.
Oh my god, I know!
And finally, Johnny deciding to confront the politician Stilson, which is actually a very great part of the film.
Yeah,
this is one of that shit really, really good. Baum said he enjoyed writing character development for Smith, having him struggle with the responsibility of his psychic abilities, and ultimately giving up his life for the greater good. Quote-unquote, it was this theme that made me like the book, and I particularly enjoyed discovering it in what was essentially a genre piece, a work of exploitation, he said. I guess. I don't know. It is a genre piece. Okay, whatever. I'm disagreeing with him on the spot. But in Baum's first draft of the screenplay, Johnny does not die at the end, but rather has a vision about the Castle Rock Killer, who is still alive and escaped from prison. So Cronenberg insisted on this trick ending be revised. Baum submitted the final draft of the screenplay on November 8th, 1982.
People just kept like coming at this screenplay. Like they were just like, we have to make revisions.
Like, buddy, it's almost brilliant, but come on, man.
I mean,
I mean, it seems like it's a pretty comprehensive novel. So upon reviewing the screenplay, they got the seal of approval from King himself. King reportedly told Cronenberg that the changes the director and Bowen made to the story, quote unquote, improved and intensified the power of the narrative. So he actually liked this one.
Because you're high, I'm going to correct you ahead of time. It says when it came to casting.
Oh, wow. That could have been a lot worse.
That's why I'm telling you now.
When it came to casting, not the other way, before Christopher Walken was cast as Johnny Smith, Bill Murray was considered for the role as it was King's first choice. Thank God.
That would have been a fucking nightmare.
Bill Murray with the assassination scene at the end? Jesus.
No, the ice is going to break.
Yeah. No, hell no.
Yeah, he couldn't do it.
Groundhog Day. That's a better choice. Yes. So, Cronenberg initially wanted Nicholas Campbell to portray Johnny, but the director wound up casting him as the Castle Rock killer instead. Cronenberg also wanted Hal Holbrook to portray Sheriff Bannerman, but De Laurentiis, of course, didn't like that shit. So.
Yeah, Cronenberg wanted a fellow Canadian for that, and De Laurentiis was just like, no!
This is the bullshit!
This is the bullshit! Anyway, so now they had to film this bitch.
Let's see how it went.
So, shooting started in January of 1983 and took place in the Greater Toronto Area and the regional municipality of Niagara of Cronenberg's native Maple Leaven, Ontario, Canada.
That's right. Jeez. I love how we always stick it to Canada, too.
Canada, Dino De Laurentiis, like, we are assholes. So, according to a David Cronenberg interview on the DVD, The Dead Zone was filmed during a relentless deep freeze in southern Ontario, which lasted for weeks, creating an authentic atmosphere of sub-zero temperatures and icy, snow-packed terrain, which made for great natural shooting locations, despite it being almost too cold for cast and crew to tolerate at times.
Jesus.
This is completely true. There is a theme park called Canada's Wonderland, which is a distance north of Toronto city limits and was also used as a filming location.
Oh, wow.
Canada's Wonderland.
Is it only open during the winter? Or what the
fuck? I have no idea. So, also, the gazebo scenes were also shot in Niagara. Town officials originally objected to the building of the gazebo itself because they built it for the movie.
Yeah.
Cronenberg assured them it would be temporary and easily destroyed. The town did eventually relent, but once officials saw the gazebo, they liked it and started using it in promotional literature for the town.
Oh, that's great. I love that.
Come to Niagara. We have a gazebo.
Among other things.
But we have a gazebo.
Now we have a gazebo. Now with gazebo.
Right. So in order to get, while filming those freaky flinchy shots of Christopher Walken, David Cronenberg fired a .357 Magnum loaded with blanks just off camera to make Smith, the character, his flinches seem more involuntary. This was Walken's own idea.
See? That's how you do it, Baldwin.
Jesus!
Sorry.
Come on, man!
Yeah, a little topical, a little topical.
It's very topical. Yeah. Thank you.
By the way, I know we actually do have Canadian listeners, like a pretty good percentage. So if you can, any of you please DM us and tell us what Canada's Wonderland is.
Yeah.
I would love to know.
I'd love to know. I know Canada is obviously huge.
Yeah, yeah. So. Yes, but if it, you know, made its way towards the other side of the
country. Yeah, I really, okay, my brother's girlfriend is also Canadian, and I really hope she doesn't listen to this because all I do is shit on Canada.
But with love, guys.
It's with love. Like, I want nothing more than to, like, you know, go to Vancouver at some point. So.
And just keep in mind how many times we shit on America.
It's true. I hate it here, and I live here, so. Yeah.
It's a love-hate thing.
It's true.
Completely.
It's true. Also a fun little tidbit, the sweat on Christopher Walken's face during the burning bedroom sequence was in fact a flame retardant chemical that had been sprayed onto him. The resulting effect, which hadn't been anticipated, looked surprisingly dramatic on film.
Jesus.
And it does look, I'm like, why is he so sweaty?
Yeah, that's true, huh? They're
but it's just to make sure he doesn't catch on fire.
Oh my gosh, that's hilarious.
Yeah. So anyway, speaking of that sequence, David Cronenberg had to reshoot the scene because the little girl's room had a small ET doll that could be seen on one of the shelves. The scene had to be reshot when Universal Pictures threatened to slap them with a fucking lawsuit.
Oh, you couldn't digitize that shit out either.
No, it's 82 at this point. Oh, they're just like, nah, buddy, we gotta reshoot it. Which it sucks because, you know, it's a pyrotechnic scene, so yeah. They had to like...
That's some budget right there.
Yeah. There were several scenes that were filmed and completed but have never been seen publicly and are thought to have been discarded prior to the film's release, which sucks, but, you know, also it's a long-ass movie anyway, so it's fine. Among them, a prologue showing John Smith as a boy who sustains a head injury during an ice hockey match.
Redundant, okay.
An alternate scene of John Smith's vision of the Camp David scene featuring Martin Sheen. In which John himself appears in the vision as a helpless spectator.
Oh, that would have been amazing. That's, Christopher Walken being Christopher Walken, like, what are you doing?
And then, this is interesting. The underwater scene of the hockey players falling through the ice was filmed at a wood bridge, Ontario swimming pool, where one of the writers worked at the time. So they're like, hey, we can sneak you in. We can film it here. They were on site for 5 days in order to film a 35-second shot. The final cut was about 7 seconds and only showed the kids falling through the styrofoam ice from water thing.
Yeah.
It's seen in the trailer. The writer did get a couple shots of Walken in the water, but he was supposed to initially be shown underwater in the shot.
Oh, shit.
And he was there for all 5 days, and he was never shown in the shot. Like, it never made it into the film, and apparently he was a little pissed because it was a Canadian
cold,
winter.
Yeah, shit. By the way, have you seen next week's film yet?
No.
Oh, so there's a very similar scene, actually.
Oh,
I'm like, back to back. Okay.
I have not seen it yet.
Oh.
I like to keep the watches as close to when we record as possible.
Oh,
that
good.
Didn't happen in this case, but...
Just so you know, it's garbage. But good garbage.
We love... I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah.
We have very different definitions of garbage.
Yeah, but it is pretty garbagey.
So, when it comes to music, this is the only of 3 David Cronenberg films that do not have a score by his friend composer Howard Shore. This was due to studio politics in which Paramount wanted a more familiar composer to write the music for the film.
Mm-hmm. I mean, as you can tell, the first excerpt we did here, there's a lot of politics going on.
A lot of like back and forth, a lot of this is obviously a very studio film, and mm-hmm. David Cronenberg, I think a lot of his vision kind of got like I guess rolled over.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
A little neutered in some ways, for sure. And then, of course, I mean, I think by this point, they're just like, you know what? No more fights. We'll use your guy.
Can't we all just get along?
That's Christopher Walken. The Dead Zone received very positive reviews upon its good old 1983 release, just like Return of the Jedi released the same year. I love 1983. It's a good year.
Okay, I was just like, wow, okay. Lots of knowledge about 1983.
It's surprising, yeah. It holds an approval rating of 90% on Rotten Tomatoes based on 48 reviews. The site's consensus reads, The Dead Zone combines taut direction from David Cronenberg and a rich performance from Christopher Walken to create one of the strongest Stephen King adaptations. It was pretty good.
Okay, 1983 was actually a really good year for movies.
Wasn't it?
Yeah, well, we got The Outsiders, we got Sleepaway Camp, we got The Hunger, we got Cujo, we got Videodrome, we got Christine, we got The Dead Zone,
mm-hmm.
we got, let's see, what else did we get? Mr. Mom, we got Scarface.
Scarface was 1983, that's right.
Yeah.
Shit.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and again, Thriller.
Twilight Zone, the movie.
It's a tougher one. It could have been good.
Psycho mm-hmm. 2.
Yeah, okay, we've
Flashdance.
Wow. Yeah. American Iconography in there too. Shit.
Return of the Jedi.
Yep, Return of the Jedi.
My personal favorite.
Yeah, it's I think my second favorite.
Interesting.
Yeah, second favorite for sure.
I just have a nostalgic attachment to Return of the Jedi. Growing up, that was my favorite.
Yeah. No, I actually really love it.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Mm. I know which one is your favorite.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Empire Strikes Back. Mm-hmm. I know. But mm-hmm. for me, it's New Hope, Return of the Jedi, Empire Strikes Back. But it's not because I don't like Empire Strikes Back. But
no, no. They're all good movies.
They're all good movies.
Yes, yes.
Oh, Staying Alive came out
19... Oh, man. Really?
Yeah, 1983.
That's the sequel to, what do you call, Saturday Night Fever.
Yeah.
That John Travolta directed and flopped. Boy, it's all coming together, isn't it?
Bringing it back.
And that's your history of 1983, everyone.
I mean, anytime he says, I really like that year, I'm like, I have to see what movies came out that year.
Hey, but that year fucking delivered, didn't it?
I mean, yeah, there's some pretty good...
There's some bangers.
There's some bangers.
Yeah, there's some bangers.
There's a movie called Microwave Massacre that came out this year. Hold on.
Put on the list. Put on the fucking list right now. I don't know what that shit is, but we need to cover that.
Oh my God.
What is that?
I don't know. Hold on. Let me... Please hold.
The listeners love this shit. So yeah, what is Microwave Massacre?
Okay. A man kills his wife in a drunken rage and disposes of her body by cooking and eating it, which gives him a taste for human flesh.
Put on the list. That's I don't know where.
It's on Tubi right now.
You know what?
It has a 4.3 out of 10 on IMDb. It could be worse.
Oh my God. Okay.
Google users gave it a 78%.
If we ever do Trash Month, that's got to be in there.
Okay. I feel like we already have Trash Month established then at this point. Well, because like there's one you want, there's one that I want, there's one that James wants.
There's one we just fucking discovered right now.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. We're coming back. Coming back. All right. So Roger Ebert, our boy of the Chicago Sun-Times, gave the film 3.5 stars, describing it, describing The Dead Zone as by far the best of the half a dozen cinematic adaptations of King's novels to date. He praised Cronenberg's direction for successfully weaving the supernatural into the everyday and noted believable performances by, of course, the entire cast, especially Walken. Quote, Walken does such a good job portraying Johnny Smith, the man with the strange gift that we forget this is science fiction or fantasy or whatever, and just accept it as this guy's story, end quote. Well, he really liked it. Okay.
Yeah, on YouTube, it has a little, it has a clip of his review with Gene Siskel.
Yeah.
It's very good.
Okay, I gotta check it out.
And hearing him, be so, passionate about how good Walken did, I was mm-hmm. just like, oh, okay, yeah. That's nice.
No, he's a movie boy.
No, obviously.
Yeah, in his heart.
But it was nice. It was sweet.
I love watching their old reviews, because when they disagree, they're bitchy.
They mostly agreed. It was just audio, so I had a hard time distinguishing who was who. But mm-hmm. One of them was just like, I think I like this more than you. And it reminded
probably
me.
Roger Ebert. But when him and Gene Siskel disagree,
it's a cat fight.
It's a cat fight. That's a good way. It's a total fucking cat fight. It's amazing. But David Kerr of Chicago Reader was more critical of the film, describing it as by no means a bad film, but a disappointingly bland and superficial one, in which director Cronenberg relinquishes the one thing that always had set him apart from his Canadian colleagues, his willingness to follow his intuitions rather than the logic of a script. Boy, I think I'm somewhere in the middle on those fuckers.
But yeah.
Yeah. That's a little mean. Meanwhile, on Letterboxd, The Dead Zone boasts a 3.5 rating out of a pretty substantial 36,500 reviews. So that's pretty good. Mm-hmm. Let's get in there.
Yeah.
Let's get in there. Oh, shit. Ian West gives the film 5 stars. Quote, undervalued Cronenberg, if you ask me, and easily my favorite offering from him behind Videodrome, The Dead Zone might not be as accessible as The Fly or filled fleshy body horror. But it is bleak, gripping, relevant, romantic, and filled with very particular Cronenberg sense of emotion. So, okay.
Yeah.
He did better than the other fucking guy, the Chicago guy.
I feel like this is a little bit more accurate. I wouldn't say it's my favorite offering from him, but I think it does, it gives it a different view of making it a Cronenberg film without, making it as, it's a gross body horror film.
Yeah, well, it is Cronenberg's take on King.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's bleak. It does have that bleakness to it, especially when it's, in this, horrible bleak. I mean, winter Canadian, like Canadian winter, where it's just like, oh, this is miserable.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know. It's a weird, we'll get into it, obviously, but it is it is an interesting beast. So Amaya was less impressed with 2 stars, saying, quote, Cronenberg and Stephen King anxious for walking. Come on, movie, you can be weirder. I know you can.
I agree with this one.
Yeah, I agree with that too. I was expecting a little bit more weirdness.
Yeah.
Jamel Boy says, simply with 4 stars, the ice is going to break.
That scene, I don't know. I loved it.
Yeah, that was good. I just had a flashback to it. And finally, Kemper with 3.5 stars. Quote, a good movie overall, but it suffers from slow pacing. It felt like a two-and-a-half-hour film when it actually is just about 1 hour and 40 minutes. I agree.
It's true. Yeah. Oh, God. It's such to the detriment of the film, too. Like, the pacing is so fucking weird.
It's weird. It's just, yeah.
It's not paced well.
No, I definitely say that. But the novel also went on to inspire a television series of the same name in the early 2000s, starring Anthony Michael Hall, the 2-hour pilot episode of which borrowed some ideas and changes used in the 1983 film.
Like, we're talking like different lores. Like Dead Zone 1983 is different from the book, which is different from the TV show, and they're all vastly different. It's very interesting.
I feel like the content in the book, there's a lot to mine from, I would imagine.
It's a good foundation, I guess you could say.
Yeah, definitely. If it's very episodic too, like usually you can kind of piece what you want out of it. So.
Definitely. So let's dive right into a fun little play-by-play.
Yay!
I would say if you really love Stephen King, if you really love Cronenberg, if you really love Christopher Walken, this is worth a watch before we go right into it.
You're definitely getting your money's worth out of it, I would say, for sure.
I do also just want to say this movie is 1 hour and 40 minutes. I watched a two-hour and 20-minute movie yesterday, and it felt shorter than this one.
But that's hard to say. Like, I forgot where I was going with that. God damn it.
You're high.
Yeah.
Damn it, Anthony.
Still a little high. I didn't mean to be.
It was an accident. I saw the look on your face when, like, I was like, just like,
I'm like, oh, it works. Oh, it works.
It works.
Oh, no. Oh, my God. Okay. Yeah. No.
Anyway, let's dive right in.
Let me get myself together.
So, after having a headache following a ride on a roller coaster in Castle Rock, Maine, school teacher Johnny Smith politely declines when his girlfriend Sarah asks if he wants to spend the night with her. And she's insistent. Yeah. And he's just like, no, I'm a gentleman. I'm going to go.
You're a special lady.
You're special. And I'm like, Jesus Christ, dude.
Oh,
it's pouring rain.
Oh, my God. Like, no, you go home in the cold.
Walk away.
So as he drives home through stormy weather, he has a car accident, and that leaves him, of course, in a coma.
Yeah, this is also in his little, like, bug. Like, he's driving like a yellow bug.
Yeah, and the accident's so weirdly telegraphed. Like, I don't know.
It's done weird.
Yeah, it kind of has almost a Final Destination kind of vibe to it. And I don't know, there's something weird about it.
It's there is a weird Final Destination vibe to it now that I think about it.
I don't know.
It's just like a perfect set of circumstances that like got him in this accident. Like if it had been like five seconds prior or 5 seconds after, he would have been fine.
Mm-hmm. And also the scene where he like wakes up from the coma. Like it's fucking like the parents are there and they're like, oh, hey, yeah, Johnny, da, 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 I love you. I miss you. Like what about what's his fucking girlfriend's name?
Sarah.
When he asked about Sarah, like, that whole scene, like, when they said 5 years, I was like, oh, shit.
Well, what's funny is, like, we're going to get into it right now. So, awakening under the care of neurologist Dr. Sam Wysick, he finds that 5 years have passed and Sarah is now a married mother. Oh. So, let's go through what happens in the yada yada.
Yes. Okay?
So, after the accident, Sarah comes to his bedside and is just like, basically like, I'll never leave you. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, you bitch.
You stupid bitch.
You fucking liar. So, and then it cuts to black and then he's waking up and then it's, you know, the doctor's there and it's just like, and it's very creepy. It's just like,
it is.
Hello, Johnny. And it's just like, oh God, okay. Do you want to see your parents? Your parents are here. And he's like, yeah. And then the parents are like a little weird. And
they're so weird.
Like, it's very weird.
They're almost like David Lynchy weird.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, Cronenberg, like, it's a small jump from Cronenberg to Lynch, right?
To the David zone. Yes.
David. Jesus. Anyway, so these parents are very kind of surreal, and it's because this doctor is like, okay, don't like just lay it on him that he's been asleep for 5 years. We have to bring it in slow. Mm-hmm. And then the mom slips up, and then he's just like, how long have I been asleep?
Oh my God, it's so dramatic.
It's so dramatic.
It's pretty soap opera.
It is very Days of Our Lives. It's very the Days of Our Lives. And then the doctor is like, it's been 5 years. And then you find out Sarah's now a married mom, and it's kind of bullshit. Like, mm-hmm. it's just like, wow, I knew you wouldn't wait. Ugh.
Oh my God. Yeah, I mean, obviously she would, but at the same time, it's also like, 5 years is a lot of time.
It's a long time, yeah, especially if it's like I don't know.
I mean, think where you were 5 years ago. Like, goddamn. Yeah. Right?
No. Yeah. No.
Yeah, anybody.
Oh my God, five years ago, I was 21 years old. No. Oh,
Jesus. Oh. Yeah. I just think of the people I'd be like, I wait for you in a coma. Now I'm like that.
Fuck that. Burn, bitch.
Yeah. I hope you don't fucking wake up. No. Okay. that's a little across the line. Right?
That's excessive.
I hope you wake up and you're okay.
I hope you wake up and you're okay. I'm going to be gone.
Yeah, yeah.
Bye.
I've had 5 years of personal growth. I'm sorry.
Still a little bit, but it's fine.
Oy, oy, oy. So, of course, with this, Johnny discovers that he can now learn aspects of people's life through physical contact. And, of course, how does he learn that, Alex? How does that happen?
Yeah, so he touches a nurse's hand and, like, has her in a fucking death grip. And mm-hmm. it's really, again, upsetting.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And she's just like, what the fuck? Anyway, he sees her daughter trapped in a fire. And this is the scene where they had to reshoot because there's an E.T. doll and mm-hmm. blah, blah, blah. And it's very, like, kind of, he's just like, your daughter, whatever her name is, like mm-hmm. Molly or whatever the fuck.
Yeah.
And she's just like, Molly, Molly. And he's just, and the nurse is like, that's my daughter's name. What the fuck? And he's like, your house is on fire. If you go now, you might be able to save her. And it's just like, what?
She's okay. Like, this is a lot to take in, man. She's like, just fucking go.
And then she takes off. And I guess she saves him.
It's oddly quickly, but I mean, she's a mom.
Yeah,
yeah, it's a mom.
Moms have superpowers. They do. We all know this. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She fucking did the DeLorean right over there.
Oh, yeah, for sure. She definitely, pedal to the metal, dude.
That was a 1985 film, by the way. So not 1983, but pretty close. Pretty close.
I mean, close enough.
Also, this scene, I believe, is a just a great case for the awesomeness of fucking practical effects.
Yeah.
It looks amazing.
It looks really cool.
It's Cronenberg just with a room on fire, and it's so good looking. Yeah, I cannot stress that enough.
Again, it is on fire because, as we know, Christopher Walken is covered in like jelly, so he doesn't catch on fire.
Very dramatic. Very dramatic. Mm-hmm. He also sees that Wyzik's mother, long thought to have died during World War II, is still alive, and that a pushy reporter's sister killed herself. So,
okay, there's a lot going on.
Yeah, this is a pretty big part of the movie, actually.
So,
Wyzak is his
doctor.
His doctor, yeah.
What is it with you and not being able to do?
Another near Travolta right now.
You can't do like ER because you've been saying like killer and doctor. And I'm like, what is going on with you?
I'm fine. We're good.
Anyway, so Wyzak's mom died, or supposedly died, in World War II after he touches his doctor's hand. And he's like, oh, no, she's alive. I'm like, how would you know that? How? You're not touching her hand. You don't know. Whatever. Anyway. And then the doctor's like, no, she's gone. You're crazy. And he investigates, and it turns out she's not. And then it kind of turns into this whole, like, media circus.
Yeah. Like, is he, like, the guy that can actually see the future?
Yeah. And then during this press thing, there's obviously some dissenting opinions. And he's like, okay, well, if you can do it, like, mm-hmm. tell me my future.
Oh, I love this scene, actually, too. It's a good scene.
It's really good. And then he's like, okay, fine. Like, I'll do it. And he announces to everyone that this reporter's sister committed suicide. And he's just like, fuck you, fuck this. Like, mm-hmm. how could you have known this? And, like, everyone freaks out. And then
this reporter's losing it.
Oh yeah,
he's fucking losing it.
And he was an asshole beforehand. I was just like, you deserve that.
Oh, this is
a prick.
This man was 1983 Steven Crowder, like, for sure. he was a Ben Shapiro kind of fucking
Ben
guy.
Ben Shapiro.
I was like, could you believe that this guy thinks he can see the future? He's like, your sister killed herself. Ah, fuck you.
the left media.
The left can't see the future. The left sees dire future. God, I hate that fucker.
Bah. Anyway, so while watching this, this happens. Mm-hmm. The next line.
Johnny's mother. You can't, you're right, I can't do it. I can't do it. Has, I did that on purpose. Has a heart attack and dies after Johnny visits her in the hospital.
She has a heart attack watching this happen because it's so upsetting. I'm like, oh, you killed your mom, you dude. Mm-mm-mm. Anyway, so as news of his gift spreads, Sheriff George Bannerman, played by Tom Skerritt, asks Johnny for help with a series of murders. But he's just like, fuck you, my mom just died, leave me alone. Like,
yeah.
I'm going to be an old like recluse now.
Yeah, and I would say this is when the movie starts to kind of slow down a little bit.
Definitely.
So, of course, Sarah visits with her infant son.
What the fuck? Okay, yeah, we're going to talk about this. Yeah, this I have
some bullshit stuff. And Johnny and she have sex. Though she declines a further relationship.
Wow. This whole scene, I was like, what is going on here?
It's, like, it's the fucking Days of Our Lives just condensed into one fuck. Like,
but it's not even dramatic. Like, it's not even, like, the husband doesn't even come into the picture later.
No.
And even then, it's just, like, a little, like, twinge of drama. It's not even, you know? And then, even then, like, there's no real drama there. I don't know. Like,
it's there just, for the setup. It's just for the sake of the setup that never fucking pays off.
No, there's no payoff. Like, it's just like, okay, we fucked, like, and then, you know,
she's like, I can't resist fucking you, but at the same time, I do have a life, so.
I do have a life, I do have an infant son, I do have a husband.
Yeah.
I definitely cheated on you, and there's, like, I have no emotional, like, recourse for that, like, I feel fine about it.
Yeah, this is your freebie. This is your freebie. 5 years, you know what? Here's a taste. Sorry about it, bro.
The taste? Sorry about it, bro. That's it. That's exactly it. And but she declines a further relationship.
Yeah.
And but it's like they have this moment where it's like her, the infant, him, his dad, they're all sitting around a table and I'm just like, this is weird.
Yeah.
So my mom and I watched this and we were just like, this is weird, right? And
yeah.
She's like, yeah, this is weird. I'm like, okay, cool.
There's too much tranquility here.
No, like, too honestly. Much. There needs to be some tension.
Mm-hmm.
So after this, I guess getting laid helped. Having a change of heart about the murders, Johnny agrees to help Bannerman. And through a vision at the crime scene, he discovers that Bannerman's deputy, Frank Dodd, is the killer. God. We're yada yada through this soggy middle because even, you know, the Wikipedia synopsis is just...
It skips through,
it's just
it?
Like, it's boring.
Yeah,
and this is at the gazebo in question that they built in Ontario, by the way.
Yeah, this is the
famous, or, I'm sorry, Niagara.
Yeah,
not Ontario.
The second biggest attraction in Niagara.
Yes.
Yeah.
Other than the falls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The falls and the gazebo. This was because of the dead zone. Yeah, it's the end of the tour. Oh, wow. Yeah, seriously, though, I think I actually went back to read the Wikipedia part because I'm like, I was kind of checking in and out of this particular section. Before they can arrest him, Dodd kills himself. Dodd's mother shoots Johnny before being killed by Bannerman. And, like, yeah, he gets shot in the arm, right? And it's all...
Back.
Back. It was the back. Yeah. She gets shot. It was weird. She was like, I don't know.
It was very, like... Firefly family. Like, it was really weird.
But I feel like there was no tension in the scene either.
No.
It was kind of like, and it's happening right now!
And then that's it!
And that's it! Okay, next scene.
This scene also kind of like just like blew its load and was just like, bye!
Yeah. You know what? Yeah, it does feel episodic in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Especially in this particular part of the film, I would say.
Agreed. So, now disillusioned and barely able to walk, Johnny moves away and attempts to live a more isolated life. You stupid fuck.
Just when I thought I was out.
Yeah.
He tutors children, working from home until a wealthy man named Roger Stewart implores him to come visit and tutor his son, Chris.
Actually, the only redeemable character in this entire movie.
The son?
Yeah. He's like just this nice little kid who's just like...
Oh, yeah.
Just like...
That's right.
Everyone just kind of is like, he has his own special interests and like he likes computers and he's a dork.
That's
he's
right.
a nerd. He's a fucking nerd and his dad is a fucking jock. And
oh, my God.
And is just like, no, son. And then
you gotta be a man, boy.
Nah. And then Johnny is just like, I'm gonna get through to you. And he does. And it works. Anyway, so they form a friendship, but Johnny soon receives a vision of Chris and the two other boys drowning in a local pond during an ice hockey game that Stewart was going to coach.
Aye, aye, aye. He implores Stewart to change his plans, but he refuses, being Stewart. He smashes a vase with his cane to make a point and, of course, is terminated.
The ice is gonna break! That's where that happens.
Yep, that's it.
Despite Stewart's skepticism, Chris believes Johnny and stays home, but the other two boys drown, greatly shocking Stewart.
This guy's onto something.
He's like, oh, shit.
Johnny realizes he has a dead zone in his visions, where the future is changeable.
Okay, I want to point out that why didn't he realize this in the very beginning when he, like, saved that little girl?
He had just woken up from the coma, Alex.
I'm just saying.
He's like, oh yeah, that happened again.
although they didn't die. I mean, they didn't die in the ice hockey incident either. I don't know. I'm just saying.
Yeah, yeah. He probably should have came to this conclusion a little bit earlier. You're right. You are right.
Logical thinking.
And this went through how many fucking people?
Critical thinking skills.
How many people and this one just fucking, oh,
also,
shit.
I feel like it does make sense that he comes to this conclusion later because, you know, it's plot.
Yeah.
Plot development.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah, no, he just had the whole, like...
We continue boldly forward.
Ay.
So, Johnny attends a rally for Greg Stilson, a superficially charismatic third-party candidate for the United States Senate, for whom Sarah and her husband volunteer.
Oh, boy.
And man, oh, man, is that an awkward encounter.
Yeah.
The husband knocks on the door. He's just like, ah,
yeah.
Greg Stilson, cool. And then Sarah meanders on up and is just like, Johnny, fancy seeing you here. Don't mention we fucked to my husband.
Yeah. I remember when that happened. I was like, is something going to go down? And I was like,
Nothing happened.
No, nothing.
Nothing happened.
Nothing, okay.
Ugh.
I guess we'll just keep the plot going along.
Yeah.
Johnny shakes Stilson's hand, revealing Stilson as a ruthless demagogue who, as president, orders what appears to be a preemptive nuclear strike.
This, like, vision scene apparently terrified my mother as a child.
Really?
For her, this was the scariest scene in the entire movie.
Well, they had that scare back in the day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean...
Oh, wait, no, she was much younger.
I mean, it wasn't that long after. I mean, she was in, when was she born? 71?
Okay, yeah, so no, she didn't probably have to deal with too much of the
I think, I mean, her parents, grandparents
sure.
did.
I imagine also the fear that they had instilled right
exactly.
to the next
generation. Exactly, that's what I'm saying. Like, and also, so she was born in 71, she was 12 when she watched this.
Damn.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's very impressionable time.
It's also,
sure.
like, around the same time, my grandparents took her to go see the Exorcist, the Poltergeist, or
Man.
See Poltergeist in theaters, and she thought it was the funniest movie ever. Like,
okay.
Nothing will humble you like a freaking preteen, man.
Oh, that's hilarious. Like, this is fucking lame.
Yes, that is exactly what she thought, and I was like, wow, Mom, wow.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Anyway, this scene, for some reason, scared the fuck out of her. Which I understand.
Yeah.
The way it's lit and the way it's shot is very, like...
It's ominous.
It's ominous. Thank
yeah,
you. That's
very
what
ominous.
I was looking for.
I would say that.
Yeah. So, Johnny seeks out Weizsäcker's advice, asking, for instance, if he would have killed Adolf Hitler if he had the chance, knowing beforehand the atrocities Hitler would commit. This is... I love that instead of just being blunt
mm-hmm.
about the situation, even though Weizsäcker knows exactly, like, Johnny's powers, he's just straight up like, would you kill Hitler? And I'm like, why are we talking about Hitler? Just tell him what's going on.
Yeah, yeah, don't.
Don't beat around the bush.
Dick around it. Like, you have cred. You have cred.
Just tell him.
Yeah.
Like, just be like, hey, this guy is going to do this thing. Should I kill him?
I like how he's like, also, Weizsäcker's like still kind of apprehensive. He's like, is this not going to, it's not possible. It's not possible.
It's not
Johnny.
Possible.
It's not
he's
possible,
just like,
Johnny.
But if you could.
Yeah. Just saying. Just fucking saying, bro.
This also just reminded me of like, so my twin brother got to talk to Kevin Smith at Comic-Con one year.
Uh-huh.
And
That's
asked
cool.
him if he would go back in time and, like, change anything about any of his movies. And he's like, no, if I could go back, I'd kill Hitler.
Oh, that's great.
And then it turned into whether or not Kevin Smith would fuck Hitler or Mussolini.
That's a good string of
it turned into
to
like
get
this
there.
Whole thing, and it's on YouTube, and it's the funniest thing ever.
Oh,
I'm gonna just
link
say,
that to
I'll just send
link
it to
it
you,
please.
And I'm just like, and it's my brother. Like, it's
yeah.
straight up. Like, and then later, he got invited to Hollywood Babylon.
Oh, that's fucking amazing.
Yeah, my brother has like the best luck with celebrities. It's the it's
okay. I gotta see this video.
Yeah,
I'll gotta send see it. To you. That is a good gift. That's a very different gift than what Stephen Walken has.
Yes. Right? No, Stephen it's very
Walken,
different.
Christopher Walken.
Stephen.
I mix Stephen King and Christopher Walken together.
Just combine right them yeah, into yeah. the weirdest person
that
ever.
That would be the weirdest person ever. I'm a writer. Anyways.
Oh my God, Cocaine Walken. Although, oh, that's yeah, pretty, that's probably. That's just Christopher
that's
Walken.
That's been there. Yeah, that's for sure. In the 80s, please.
In the 80s. Everyone.
Oh my God.
Everyone was indulging in the booger sugar. Please.
Oh, I was going to make a Natalie Wood joke there. Just,
no.
I have to skip that one. No. We already did the Baldwin.
Yes. We are. Although, enough time has passed.
For Natalie Wood, you're right. Jesus. We're good at film history, though. Look at us. I'm kind of impressed here with the string of references.
Oh, no, I got you. I'm with it today.
Hell yeah. Anyways, Wyzik basically says, like, yeah, I have no choice. Like, I'd kill this motherfucker. Mm-hmm. I would do it. After prodding. Much prodding.
After much, like, would you do it? Would you kill Hitler? Would you do it? Would you kill Hitler?
It's like, fine. No choice, buddy. All right? Fine. No fucking choice.
Fine. I'll do it. Mm-hmm. Even though he's like, fine. Like, he's not even the one doing it.
Yeah.
Anyway, Johnny leaves Sarah a letter telling her that what he is about to do will cost him his life, but it is a worthwhile sacrifice.
And that is a radicalized Johnny right there.
I know. He turns into like, I'm like, what is going on here? What in Jesus. The Oklahoma City?
Seriously, right?
See, I can also make references. Oh my God.
Johnny McVeigh. Ay, ay, ay.
Okay.
Anyways, Johnny loads a rifle and takes aim at Stilson at a rally. With Sarah in the audience. This is such a fucked up part.
Oh my God. Okay, yeah. So let's stop here for a minute. Not only, like, the... I know this is, like, obviously very, very pre-9/11. Uh-huh. But the, like, security measures for a place where a potential, like, Senate member is happening, there's none.
Yeah.
He just breaks a window. He breaks in. He's sleeping in the balcony.
Well...
Which is basically a sniper's nest. Yeah. It's a sniper's nest. And, like, no one thinks to check it beforehand for potential snipers. I don't know. Like, it is, like, obviously for the plot, it needs to happen. But I'm like, come on.
I feel like they're just trying to wrap it up at this point. Because this is also after Robert Kennedy, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. Hold on. Let me see.
Let's check our sources.
Yeah. Robert Kennedy assassination.
No, 68. Yeah, definitely way after.
Yeah. I knew there was an 8 in the date somewhere. Yeah.
20 years later.
Yeah, so it was fucking... They had the measures.
Yeah.
They totally had the fucking measures at this point. But hey, they gotta wrap it up. We're climax territory.
I know, they were like,
here.
We gotta keep it going.
Climax territory here.
Anyway, so... his shot, his first one, misses the target, but Stilson grabs Sarah's baby, which, by the way, she just so happens to be invited onto stage, like, just by a split decision. I'm like, great. And grabs Sarah's baby and holds him as a human shield, which, to be expected, little bitch.
Yeah.
Bitch behavior.
He gives off the vibe, for sure.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Johnny refuses to risk hitting the child. A photographer snaps a picture of Stilson holding the baby, of course, though, because that's a good shot.
It's the shot.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. So Sarah retrieves her baby, but before Johnny attempts to fire again, he is shot by Stilson's bodyguard.
Yeah. And, of course, confronted by Stilson, Johnny grabs his hand and foresees Stilson's reputation and political ambitions, of course, being ruined after the photograph of his cowardly act is published. Stilson will, of course, commit good old suicide.
Any narcissist would. Mm-hmm. So this scene, it's so funny. He's, like, dying. He's laying there. And then Stilson is just like, who sent you?
Yeah.
Who sent you? And he's just like, okay.
It is best Martin Sheen. Just Martin Sheen ended up.
Oh, it's, like, yeah. Which,
it's great.
Yeah. It's pretty good. And he just grabs his arm. And it also, this cutscene, or cutscene, like, it's a fucking video game.
I know, right? It's flash forward.
Flash forward. This vision.
Mm-hmm.
It's also very creepy and very well, like,
yeah.
It's the same light. It's very good. I enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
So as Johnny lays dying, satisfied that the Holocaust has been averted, again, that's Wikipedia's phrasing, not mine.
All right.
Has been averted. Sarah embraces Johnny and tells him that she loves him as he dies.
See, and that's what the Days of Our Lives things comes in right
It just
there.
All comes together. And that's the fucking movie. It just cuts to credits.
Yeah, out of nowhere, too. That's
the movie.
I mean, there was... It was like quiet credits. I don't know. It was weird.
It just was just like, ah, drama. Now, the credits.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an interesting one. Now that when you break it down scene by scene, I'm like, yeah, I can see the rhythm that they were aiming for. But also Cronenberg's style, I don't think meshes with... This could have been more of like a Scorsese... Like, it needed a quicker pace, okay. I think, for sure.
Sure, I can see that.
Cronenberg's a lingerer.
He lingers.
Yeah. But hey, that was the Dead Zone, huh?
Yay, the Dead Zone.
All right. What'd you think?
I liked it.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it had been slightly overhyped for me.
Yeah.
Because my mom loves this movie. Mm-hmm. Like, she loved it. It was one of the movies that she had on, like, VHS or whatever that she would watch when she was homesick. Oh. Like, this was one of her homesick movies.
That's pretty cool, though. That's pretty cool.
That is very... I think it's pretty cool.
A Cronenberg at home... Okay, I like that.
Yeah, but it's also, like, you know, it's not, like, a Cronenberg movie. Like, mm-hmm. if she had been like, I watched The Fly, I would have been like, cred.
Oh, you know what? I did have a Cronenberg movie that was in the VHS that we had that I would watch. Existence.
Oh.
Yeah, that was my Cronenberg go-to.
I've never seen it.
Oh, it was pretty... Oh, it was probably actually not good.
It's probably not good.
Not a thing, but it's really probably not that good. But I loved it. Because it was that Independence Day. We're pretty back and forth, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, 1997.
Yeah, for me, it was Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Independence Day, X-Men 2.
Yeah, X-Men 2. That was a good one.
Yeah.
That was the time.
But yeah, I did like it. Again, it's just... It is the soggiest middle.
Mm-hmm.
It is... Like, wet.
Yeah, how do you tell a murder mystery, like, so kind of bland?
Well, it is truly set into three parts, right? Where we have a very strong beginning, mm-hmm. where it sets it up very, very well. And then we have this very weird middle where he's trying to figure out his place in life.
It's like a side story, almost. Like,
it's a side quest,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
And then we have this third part where he's like, okay, I have my, like, reason for living, or I have this, like, mm-hmm. I guess... task that's going to kill me, but it's for the greater good, and he does it. And I even then, this like third part, because I wouldn't even include the tutoring part, like that's kind of wrapped into like the, it's like a very slow beginning, to this third act.
Yes.
Because the end of the third act, I would say, is like, I don't know, 15-20 minutes. Like, it's not long.
It's not long compared to the rest of the movie.
No, where he, like, shakes his hand, realizes he's gonna, like, nuke the world,
mm-hmm.
Realizes he has to kill him, and then kills him. Like, that takes place over the course of easy 15-20 minutes.
I feel like that should have been alluded to a lot earlier in the movie.
Absolutely.
Like, a lot earlier,
like,
in the movie.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Like, he should have been struggling with, like, should I or should I not do it?
Yeah.
Like, can I really change it?
And he immediately decided. Like, he's like, nope. Only answer, gotta kill him. Gotta do it.
Mm-hmm. I just need some verification from my doctor. Doctor, is it good? Am I good? Yeah, okay, I'm good. Let's go.
Can you morally absolve me from this?
Yeah. I need somebody. Somebody, doctor.
Please. And, so, what about you? What are your thoughts?
I'm on them kind of in the same boat, honestly. I enjoyed the setup a lot.
I wasn't sure if you were going to, like... I wasn't sure. Like, I thought we were probably going to be in the same boat. Mm-hmm. But I was like, oh, no, he could hate it. I mean, I didn't think you were going to love it, but I didn't
know. That's a good point. Because I liked it. I know I could have liked it more. But I think... You know, that's just maybe the style of the filmmaking. Like,
I feel like if I had seen it earlier or mm-hmm. had the ability to form some kind of nostalgic attachment to it, I don't know.
Yeah, there's a lot of good elements here I think mm-hmm. that could make for that.
So, like, that's what makes me sad about it, though, is, like, there are so many, like, amazing elements, but for some reason it just isn't cohesive. Like one stroke of brilliance away from being a really fucking amazing movie.
That's what I'm saying. I think Cronenberg was just not the right director for it, unfortunately. Although, to be fair, I don't think the special effects could have been done any better with anybody but Cronenberg.
Like, the special effects are really good.
They're like fucking solid, honestly.
I mean, so we kind of yada yada through the Castle Rock killer, but his death is gnarly.
Yeah.
The man impales himself through the eyes on a pair of scissors.
I actually forgot about that one for a second. It's
gnarly. Mm-hmm. I was expecting to see all the guts and gore because it was a Cronenberg film, but the fact that the initial script was so brutal that even Cronenberg was like, this is bad. Like, this is gnarly. Like, even him. Like, I was like, what was in it?
I know. I would have totally liked to see it.
Directed by Cronenberg? I don't know. But I don't know if it was a direction issue. I think, honestly, for me, I think it was a studio interference issue.
Okay, that makes more sense. Yeah, I agree. I can see
feel
that
like if he had, like, carte blanche to, like, do what he wanted, or, like, I feel like Cronenberg and King could have, like, I also feel like it was an ego battle.
No, that probably too, to be honest.
But that's the issue when you have, like, you know, so many big names like this. You have Stephen King, you have David Cronenberg, you have Deborah Hill, you have Christopher Walken, you have all of these big names where technically this should have been an amazing fucking movie. Yeah. But there was just like something, just like a je ne sais quoi, like just like something fucking missing just to make it a little, you know, spicy. Well,
and the writer too. That's what you said earlier. He's done some really big stuff.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things that I think everybody had legitimacy to their changes. Mm-hmm. Like people had basically the stature, but you got everybody kind of in an equal footing. So nobody's going to give space.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to give space.
Jeffrey Boehm did Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, The Lost Boys, Lethal Weapon 2 and 3. You know what I mean? Like,
damn, man.
He has some writing credit.
That's a pretty good pedigree right there. Yeah. So, I mean, really, like I think maybe too many cooks in the kitchen also. Like, that really could be it.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's also a studio Cronenberg film, which is always something that's a little iffy. Off.
Well, I mean, same thing with The Fly, right? Like, there was studio interference with The Fly, even. Mm-hmm.
But he made it work really well. He learned his lesson from The Dead Zone by that point.
Yeah, well, yeah. No, because The Fly came out after.
Yep.
So he was just like, I'm going to do it my way.
Yeah.
Fuck you guys.
Yeah. The Dead Zone walked so The Fly could run.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So that being said, where does this shape up in the grand scheme of things as a Stephen King adaptation?
Honestly, pretty good. Like, as much as I'm, like, apprehensive about the film being great, because I don't think it's great, I think it's good.
Yeah.
But in a pantheon of Stephen King adaptations?
Pretty good.
Pretty good. There's been some bad ones for sure. Like if good old Pet Sematary director took this material, it would be a lot worse.
Oof. Yeah.
It would be a lot worse. It'd be a lot worse.
It's definitely not Pet Sematary. I would say it's better than that. Mm-hmm.
Well, okay. So I would actually say it's one of the most well-made Stephen King adaptations. It might be missing some of the heart of some of the cheesier, shittier ones.
Okay.
But it still does its own thing. Which I think is pretty good.
I agree.
How about you? How does it stack up?
I think it has the essence of Stephen King attached to it enough that I feel like it fits well into the pantheon.
Yeah.
Obviously, anything that, you know, takes place in Castle Rock, Maine, like, I'm just like, okay.
Yeah.
It's a Stephen King movie.
Mm-hmm.
Also, The Castle Rock Killer. I know Hulu has the TV show Castle Rock. You know, it's a Stephen King, like, kind of, like, lore type thing. I enjoy it as a Stephen King adaptation. I think it, obviously there are stronger ones, but also I'm very excited to cover more Stephen King in the future because there's quite a few that I haven't seen.
I mean,
I mean, we still haven't covered The Stand.
Cujo.
Christine.
Yeah.
You know, there's...
And Christine's Carpenter and King.
Yeah. Which Christine, I'm very excited to cover.
Yeah, me too.
Like, I'm very, very excited for that. And then The Stand is one of my all-time favorites.
Mm-hmm.
Another nostalgic attachment that, like, I watched with my mom. Like, again, my mom, like, surprisingly has some attachment to horror, even though she hates horror movies.
King fan, huh?
I think so. Yeah. I think she just likes Stephen King and doesn't realize it.
Because I was, as I was watching, I don't know. This came to my mind when I was a kid.
She liked It, too. I think she just likes Stephen King.
let's say another one where I would say has a lot of heart but is poorly made, but has so much heart, it makes it very entertaining, is which is something we should totally watch next Thanksgiving because of the title. Children of the Corn. Another one of those where I'm just
It's cheesy.
Yeah. But it was the same thing. My mom was like, oh, yeah, you'll love this movie.
Yes.
But then she also maybe watched The Omen and all this other shit.
Yes, my friend Becca, who's designing our shirts and stinkers, they love Children of the Corn, and I promised them that they could guest for that.
Okay, good. It's a fun movie. I watched it so much as a kid, like a lot.
Mm.
Yeah, it's a good one. But it's also garbage. It's great. It's good garbage.
Yeah, no, I remember watching the VH1 I Love the 80s about Children of the Corn, and it was just so funny watching people riff on it.
Like, Malachi.
Yeah. Or just like them talking about, like, I can't drive past a field of corn now. And I'm like, oh, shit.
Cultural touchstone. Still King.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so what about a Cronenberg How does it shape up as a Cronenberg flick?
You know, it still feels like a Cronenberg movie.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's just Cronenberg light to me.
Cronenberg light.
It is. It's Cronenberg light. But it's still there. His essence is still there. It's just not as pervasive, I think.
I feel like Stephen King kind of obviously because it's his story.
Yeah.
Overwhelmed. But that makes total sense. Mm-hmm. There's a whole series of interviews where Cronenberg is interviewed, and then so is Deborah Hill, and so is, what's his fucking name? Martin Sheen.
Okay.
They're all interviewed about making this movie.
Dang, that's pretty cool.
It was really cool. But they kind of asked him about that, about, you know, how do you feel about covering a Stephen King film? Because this is, I want to say, only his second or third movie that wasn't written by him.
Yeah.
And he said all the usual interview, blah, 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 blah.
That's an honor, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it was really cool. Like, it was a really cool thing to consider, where I was just like, oh, man, he usually is just like, this is my story.
Yeah.
And he has that vision. But having to take someone else's vision and be like, okay,
mm-hmm.
gonna write it, do my best. And, yeah.
I feel like when we, because not to bring up, like, it is his adaptation of this material. But I think the parts that we were talking about earlier that were like, oh, it has some, like, good stuff, like, mm-hmm. just some gems that, like, it could be good, but it's mm-hmm. missing something. I think the stuff that's really good is very much Cronenberg's hand at it. Like, the visions and the special effects and all that's, like, Cronenberg's, it fits in with the rest of his style, and I think those good elements, I think Cronenberg has a lot to do with them. And all the other stuff that kind of drag it along doesn't feel comparable to other Cronenberg films we've covered. In terms of, like, the drag.
Okay, yeah. Understandable. Yeah, so it's Cronenberg light. I wholeheartedly agree.
There we go. Yay!
So, moving on from that, out of the Cronenberg movies we've covered, because it is Cronenberg Christmas, after all.
That's right.
We've covered so far The Fly, Videodrome, Scanners, and now The Dead Zone. Where does this rate among the other three? Give your whole rating.
Four.
One to four? Okay, go through them.
Fuck, that's tough, because the first three are really tough.
I have mine, so I can do mine first if you want.
You do yours first.
Okay. Mine's The Fly, Scanners, Videodrome, and then The Dead Zone.
As number one?
The Fly, one.
Oh, okay.
Scanners, two. Videodrome, three. The Dead Zone, four.
You know what? Exact same here. Exactly the same. Exactly the same,
that's
actually.
Funny.
Yeah.
No, I really, really like Scanners.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I'm going to have to re-listen because I could be contradicting myself, because I feel like we did this in Scanners where I was like, oh, where does this rate? And I totally could be bullshitting myself. But
Things change.
Opinions change. Opinions People totally change. But yeah, I think that's where I lie with that.
Okay. I agree.
That was easy.
No debate. No debate at all. No. Good. The Fly is like a resounding number one.
I love The Fly. And again, it's one of our worst performing episodes.
Yes.
But it has such a special place in my heart.
It's a great episode.
It is
honestly
such a good movie. Yes. It is such a special episode.
We watched it on the projector.
Aw.
Yeah, that shit was great.
Yeah, no, I think it's just special for me because I remember writing it on, like, at my mom's place on mm-hmm. Thanksgiving, and it being the first episode I ever wrote.
Oh, man. That was fun. Good old 4 years ago.
God.
I know. A whole high school away.
Jesus, a whole college, a whole undergrad.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Okay, so there, I feel like there might be some debate about whether this is a horror film, a psychological thriller, which is it? Is it neither? Is it both? Where do you lie on this?
It's more of a thriller.
Okay.
Definitely more of a thriller. It has horror elements for sure. But I mean, it falls in the same line of Stephen King adaptations like Misery, like where you can't really quite tell what it is.
I'd say Misery's a horror film.
Misery, yeah.
For me, Misery's a horror film.
Well, you know, actually Misery's probably a bad comparison. I don't know, but there's other stuff to it. Maybe the snow threw me off. But there's something about it that obviously isn't pure horror,
mm-hmm.
but I think the thriller elements are stronger in it. Like the sense of mystery. And there's a lot of dilly-dallying that's not often
in horror.
My mom
hates The Shining, so maybe not for Stephen King. Although Stanley Kubrick might have something to do
with
that.
Yeah, that could be it too.
I'm like going through all Stephen King movie adaptations now. I'm like, oh, my mom likes that.
Yeah.
Anyway, for me, I would say this is more of like a psychological drama than a thriller horror film.
Yeah, there's this. It just, it winds down a lot sometimes.
Well, I, like, there's some vaguely spooky elements, but mm-hmm. I feel like there isn't, like, that horror element, which, again, is, I mean, and I could be desensitized at this point, but there isn't really anything scared. There's dread.
Yes, there's definitely dread.
There's dread, and it's dreary, and it's kind, and it's like emotionally like kind of evocative at parts, but like it's not, I would say maybe thriller mm-hmm. at most. It's not a horror film to me personally. don't yell at me. Yeah, but I would categorize it more as a psychological drama than anything else.
Yeah, I get that. I would agree with that categorization. Because it's not really thrilling.
It's not a thriller. It's not like there's like little zingers where it's just like, na-na-na, you know?
Yeah. Honestly, it's almost anthological in the way it's portrayed.
Really, that is a really great way to put it. Absolutely. Because right. like the way that it goes in between all three acts, like mm-hmm. there's like this it might as well have like a, you know, a cut screen that's just like 2 years later or yeah. whatever, you know.
Or like a little, give each segment
a title.
Yeah, give
it a title. If it had done that, I feel like that would have been very interesting mm-hmm. too.
Like the fucking Castle Rock Killer, one title right there.
Yeah, oh, that would have been, actually.
And then Bye Bye Hitler.
The Fall or whatever you want to call it.
Future proof.
That would have been really cool, actually.
Yeah, I think that actually would have helped the pacing of it, too, because you kind of get something to anticipate.
Mm-hmm. Like, it's like part one, the accident, part two, you know, Castle Rock Killer, part three, whatever you want to call
the
it. The Dead Zone. Yeah! Damn, why didn't we write this movie?
we were not even thought of no. at that time when this was...
No.
Yeah.
No, my mom was 12. okay, so... Moving on, as we wrap on up, you wake up and suddenly it's 5 years later. Mm-hmm. It is November of 2026. What do you do?
Well, at first I check to see, I grab the nearest person's arm and try to figure out what's going on in their lives.
Right. So yeah. But that falls apart. You check to see if you have powers.
Yeah. Most likely don't have any powers. Cool, I didn't have any powers from the car accident, so, you know, I imagine that wouldn't work.
Okay.
And then I go on the pure social media crawl of how badly do people miss me? I have to know. I read all the comments, the things.
There you go. Okay.
Who secretly loved me? Who did all this shit? I just did the whole thing.
Who came and like confessed their love? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then assuming my Twitter, my Tinder and Bumble accounts haven't been deactivated, I just look to see if I've accumulated any matches over the years.
Jesus.
And then see the ones that I do remember and be like, how much have you changed?
Okay.
And then, you know, the usual thing of like, how have you been?
I've been in a coma for 5 years. Have you been?
You know what? No, I let them all come to me. How about that?
I mean, you know, your legs are probably atrophied, so you're not going to be doing much walking.
Yeah. So basically just the phone stuff and trying to see if I have powers. Those are the two things. Yeah.
I'm immediately checking to see who's president.
Oh, yeah. That's a good idea.
Yeah. Immediately.
Mm-hmm. How good is my healthcare? Because... depending on the administration, this could have been cost a lot over 5 years.
Yeah. Who fucking knows? Yeah, same thing. Hoping, you know, I'm hoping I wake up and it's like a room full of flowers because after 5 years, I'm still missed.
Mm-hmm. What if they're all dead flowers? And they just like, even the hospital didn't care.
That would just mean people really know me well. Yeah. They're like, bring her the dead ones.
Well, these were dead already a long time ago, lady. We're hoping the pungent smell would have woke you up.
Nope. And then the second thing, I'd be like, who the fuck is taking care of my cats?
Oh, yeah. Do they still love me?
No, they would still love me.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Bowie
would
be... a midlife crisis?
I know. He'd be like, oh, my God, I thought you were dead.
Oh, Britannia just being this old bitch.
Yeah, right. I'm like, Jesus Christ, you're fucking alive.
She's like, eh, it's fucking
leave me. She'd be old. Mm-hmm. Old after 5 years, too. Yeah, and then I would be 31.
Jesus.
And just wake up and be in my 30s.
Hey, 31's a good year. It's a good year.
I understand, but I would like to remember the rest of my 20s.
That's a good point. Yeah, I agree.
Like, would I like to just jump to my 30s? Yes, but I also feel like there's some life lessons I have to learn between now and then to, like, get to that point.
Oh, yeah, you don't want to have to go through your late 20s and your early 30s body. Not a fun time.
No.
Yeah. No, you need to learn those lessons so that you like 30.
Yeah. I'd like to like 30. I'm enjoying my like late 20s now, but it's all good now, mm-hmm. but I'm from what I've been told, it only gets better.
Yeah. No. Yeah, honestly, right when you turn 30, it's great. Yeah. All that fear you had about turning 30 is gone. You're like, it's here.
Okay. It's here. Well, I'm still here.
Well, what do I do now?
Life continues continuing. Okay, so I'm glad we've figured this out for ourselves.
Yeah, we made our 5-year plan. Yeah.
We've made our our 5-year plan. Again, immediately asking who's president. I just really would want to know. Okay, rate this movie out of 5 dramatic eye locks.
Oh, geez, out of 5 of those?
Because there's so many in this movie. Just like, ah!
Yeah, you know what? I'll give it a 3.
Okay.
Give it a 3. I think it's a little above half for me.
I watched this in my October, like, watch thingy. I gave it 3.5. I'm going to stand by it. I gave it 3.5 out of 5. I'll stand by it. I enjoyed it. It just the pacing just drove me nuts.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I agree. Again, if they made it more episodic, like, clearly, I think that would have given my mind time to, like, readjust
to the segments. It would have given your mind something to, like, kind of split it up properly.
Yeah.
But, yeah,
and I agree. Assess on its own terms. Mm-hmm. Or its individual terms, I guess.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. All right. 3.5 out of 5.
We're good.
You 3 out of 5. For once, I'm actually rating above you.
Yeah.
Oddly. Weird. But that is it for The Dead Zone from 1983. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening. Next week.
Oh, next week we're actually covering something I'm actually really excited about.
This is a callback all the way to season 1.
A callback to season 1. It's a sequel. It is a Christmassy movie, surprisingly.
It's a Christmas movie and it's a callback to season 1. Okay.
Yeah, it's fucking weird. It's one movie I watched a lot as a child,
mm-hmm.
and I learned as an adult, it is schlocky.
But
it's schlocky, but as a kid, I thought it was the most serious dramatic shit. So it's going to be very interesting. And yes, a callback to early season 1. Like early season 1. Yeah, like it took 4 years.
Like single digit season 1, right?
Yep. It took us 4 years to do the sequel to this one.
Good lord.
So yeah, it's going to be a fun play-by-play. I'll tell you that right now.
Ooh, there's a play-by-play.
Oh, it has to be. Schlocky.
Okay. Very excited. And then next... Or actually, so we have that next week's episode, and then we have one more episode after that, and then we are taking 2 weeks off for the holiday season.
Yes.
Just keep that in mind, and then we're going to be coming in hot for 2022, so more updates as that comes along, but we only have 2 more episodes for 2021.
That's right.
Holy shit.
I know.
So yeah, thank you so much, everyone, for listening. If you like what you heard, please subscribe wherever you're listening on all the podcast apps. And then if you're listening on iTunes, please give us a 5-star rating or write us a review on iTunes. It does mean the world, and it does help other people find this podcast. Mm-hmm. We can boast a very cool 5-star rating on iTunes.
Yes.
So please check that out if you have an iPhone, or find a friend who has an iPhone and be like, hey, I gotta do something real quick.
Oh, I gotta do that today, actually. Okay, good.
And then if you think we deserve a couple bucks for what we do have a Patreon. You can check us out on patreon.com/horrorpeoplepod. And yeah, we have tiers as low as $5 a month, so check that out. And then if you want to stay up to date on the latest and greatest and all of our podcast shenanigans, we are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are on Facebook and Twitter at Horror People Pod,
mm-hmm.
and we are on Instagram at Horrible People's Podcast. That is HORRORBLE People's Podcast. And then if you want to follow Anthony, he's on Twitter and Instagram at Hyrulean Hustler. Mm. And then you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Ghost Coffee Shop. I just got a Switch for Christmas.
That's right.
So I've been playing Stardew Valley and Pokemon Shining Pearl or whatever the fuck.
Oh, it is Shining Pearl. I got Brilliant Diamond. We're being a duo, and I am handing Alex some Pokemon for her journey.
It's true. I've never played a Pokemon game in my life.
I'm your Sherpa. I am guiding you through the whole
experience. You're my Yoda.
Yep, that's right.
So yeah, that's kind of what we're up to right now.
That is why you failed.
Thank you so much, everyone, for listening, and I hope none of you fall into a 5-year-long coma, and if you do, I hope you get powers out of it, at least.
And then be careful for ice, please.
Yeah. Bye, guys.
See ya.